Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. When we talk about gay liberation and gay rights in the United States, it's easy to oversimplify the history with a series of bullet points. The riots at Stonewall in 69, sexual freedom and liberation in the 70s, the HIV/AIDS crisis of the 80s and 90s, and the fight for marriage equality, with Massachusetts leading the way in 2004. But historian Jim Downs says the narrative is incomplete and oversimplifies a complex movement that included gay religious groups, the gay press, and a connection to black civil rights. Jim Downs is a professor of history at Connecticut College and a fellow at Harvard University. His new book is Stand By Me, The Forgotten History of Gay Liberation. And he joins us now. And Jim Downs, welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So in your book, you say that one of your goals with this work is to show that gay liberation in the 70s was about much more than free love. Can you explain how that misunderstanding came to be in the first place?
So I think that definitely throughout the 1970s, this free love concept was a major hallmark of the period. But what happened was in the early part of the 1980s, with the outbreak of HIV/AIDS, doctors, policymakers, journalists, and even gay people themselves had no idea how this epidemic was spreading and spreading so quickly. And so they turned back to the 1970s and they saw the ways in which the 1970s gave way to this massive sort of sexual culture. And they started looking at that sexual culture and they started to say, well, you know what? We think that HIV spread due to promiscuity, and it spread to as a result of the bathhouses, the bars, the sort of general sort of sexual libertine culture of the sexual libertine sort of tenor of the period. And some of that is true, but much of that is based on a sort of narrative about promiscuity that actually undermines the epidemiological realities of how HIV transmission works. In other words, HIV transmission works as a result of having sex with one person and being infected with one person. It's not a result of multiple figures. But what happened was the 1970s began to sort of almost become a caricature, and it served as a way of explaining how HIV spread. And as a result, so much of the 70s, so much of that history got overshadowed. So
you're talking about things like, for instance, I mean, the connection with religion and the gay movement, for example.
Right. So one of the things that happens in the 1970s is that there's just as many churches being built in the 1970s, actually more gay churches being built in the 1970s than bars and bathhouses. And in places where you couldn't have a bar, you could have a church. And these churches existed sometimes in the basement of someone's home. Sometimes they rented churches from leading denominations. So gay people throughout the United States, in the Midwest, in the South, and even in urban places, they fled to religious organizations for shelter, and they created this massive religious network, which gets overshadowed by this larger narrative of gay promiscuity.
This is really interesting. And you start early in the book, you tell this terrible story of a prayer meeting in New Orleans, which was attacked and set ablaze. Tell us about this and how it sort of fits into this idea of a forgotten history. What happened?
Right. So what happens is a bunch of these guys gather in the second floor of a bar in New Orleans that they was called the Upstairs Lounge, and they were there earlier that afternoon celebrating the fourth anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising. So they're having drinks, they're dancing to Cher, they're having this huge party, and then around 7 o'clock the beer bust ends, and members of the Metropolitan Community Church, which is one of these gay churches, met in the Upstairs Lounge. And it's New Orleans, and it's the 1970s, and so the place is it's sort of barricaded. It's a barricaded bar. That is to say that in order to get in, it sort of looks like one of those prohibition speakeasies. They had a hatch that they had to open in order to see if the person was, in fact, gay. There were bars over the windows. And someone came knocking, and they said, listen, there's a religious service going on. And eventually the person left. Someone came back, and we don't know who or whom or how many people there were, but they threw a firebomb on the steps that detonated, and it blew up this room. And because there were bars over the windows, because it was in a sort of secluded part of the city, because it was a place where there were bars created to sort of prevent crime and other problems. People were trapped.
Oh,
and as a result, over 32 people died. And it's the largest massacre of gay people in U.S. history. And it's a story that has not been told. And it's a story that even when the popular media went to report on it, they often sort of had sort of homophobic jokes. Someone would ask, how many gay people died? And they would say, not enough.
Oh, or, boy.
Yes. Yeah,
so, was there ever a suspicion that help didn't come because of what was going on in there? I mean, because of the community.
Right.
That
so
was
the
in
fire
there?
Department, I've gone through the police records. I've gone through the fire department records. The fire department, the call got logged in at like 6:59. The fire department came by 7:03, 7:04. That wasn't the problem. Mm-hmm. The problem was, for example, one is how they handle the bodies. Mm-hmm. And the bodies were kept there in the upstairs lounge for over a day. One of the bodies was the Reverend Troy, Reverend Larson, and his body, he was trying to sort of get out of one of the windows. He pushed an air conditioner through the window, and an air conditioner on the floor above fell on him, and he got trapped. And someone who worked at the bar down below came by to pick up the cashier's box or the safe to check on things, and realized that his body was still sort of wedged in the window. So it was how people handled it. And you think about Black Lives Matter, you think about what happened in Ferguson, you think about sort of Michael Brown's body being left on the street. This is what happened in New Orleans. Reverend Larson's body was left in the window for over 24 hours.
Oh, awful. I'm glad you wrote up Black Lives Matter, because I want to ask you about something else that you write about in terms of this forgotten history, and that is the way that the gay rights movement and the black civil rights movement were intimately connected at the time.
Right. Well, what I think most people sort of forget is that most gay liberation activists came out of the black freedom struggle, black civil rights, and also the feminist movement. And so much of gay liberation developed as a part of these movements. And throughout the early 1970s, gay liberation activists remained steadfastly committed to anti-racism. But by the end of the decade, we sort of see some of that begin to dissipate. And why, I think it's kind of complicated. I'm not really necessarily sure. But at the very beginning, in the early part of the 1970s, you see a really robust political effort among gay liberation activists to also be part of the black freedom struggle.
Really interesting. Jim Downs, his new book is Stand By Me, The Forgotten History of Gay Liberation. He'll be talking about his new book tonight at the Harvard Bookstore. You can find a lot more information at our website, radioboston.org. And Jim Downs, thanks for coming in. It's a fascinating read. I'm very grateful that you came in to talk about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.